I didn't even have to look. Like it was, and I yelled at Clay. I'm like, Clay, we gotta go to the hospital. And the vehicle's about 15 feet away and I'm in the passenger seat. And I'm like, okay, am I getting into shock? And I'm like, I think I see my thumb in the outfeed. You know, the exhaust outfeed, right? I'm like, oh no, I must be in shock. Right? And I'm looking, I'm like, I think that's my thumb in there.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Efficient by Design podcast. Today, I have my brother, Brad, co-hosting again, and a special guest. This is Brooks Lancaster, a long time Penticktonian. Is that how you?
I think that's what you're
Is that right, it? Actually?
Sure. That sounds about right. Penticktonite. Awesome. Penticktonite.
Penticktonite.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say.
All right. I wasn't so good. Yeah. So my interactions with Brooks started... and kind of ended. Like it wasn't, we weren't really engaged with one another for very long. We rubbed shoulders from time to time for a few years, but when Dustin and I started Acrobus Construction and we transitioned out of flooring into framing, the very first job we got, we were brought in to do framing on this nice home. And the builder we're working for that brought us on, I asked him, when can we start? And you'll let us know when the concrete's done and we'll come and frame. And they said, what are you talking about? That's not how it works here. Framers do their own concrete. Which is where I kind of swallowed hard, and I'm thinking back to like my bit of schooling, no hands-on practical experience at all, because I came from background of framing primarily in Alberta, and Matt, he says, yeah, well, you guys got to do it, and I was very honest. I'm like, okay, I'm not opposed to this, but if we're gonna have to do this, I need help. We'll have to bring somebody in that can kind of guide us through our first foundation or two to get our feet wet, and Brooks was the guy. So Brooks, you and Kenny was the other gentleman. Yep,
Ken Murray.
And you guys, I think at the time, this is up in Heritage Hills, this high-end development up in the hills above Skaha Lake. Mm-hmm. I think you guys were working on the lot was called HH5.
Right.
I believe.
You're absolutely right.
That's right.
Yep, which so that is now 148 Apple Court.
Okay. Right? And it was like a 7,500, 8,000 square foot custom timber frame, crazy, amazing place.
Yeah, it was absolutely. That was probably the most challenging build I've ever done. For
really?
Sure. And one of the most proudest.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So he was basically working up the street from us. We were down kind of in the same kind of area. It was maybe a 4-minute drive down to our site. Mm-hmm. What was it? I want to say Schoenwills. That's not right. Do you remember the name of the project?
That almost rings a bell.
Schoenwill? I think that might be right.
I think it was Schoenwill.
And for yeah, I have
that's
a terrible,
pretty good for
I have a terrible memory. But some of these, good, yeah. My wife's gonna be mad. She's like, "You remember those things?
Yeah.
What about what's happening next week?
Yeah. Yeah. What about your wife's birthday?
Yeah. Anniversary.
Oh man. Yeah. Anniversary. That's
coming up pretty quick. I think you mentioned. So
that's in 8 days.
There you go.
20 years. Yeah. So anyway, Brooks and Kenny that were working up on HH5 for the same builder. Then basically came down and helped Dustin and myself, and you were with mm-hmm. us too.
Yeah, he was dragging forms around. I remember that.
So you were, that was like the very beginning for you.
First ever construction for me, pretty much. Yeah.
That we awesome. Could barely tell.
Yeah. I believe it.
So Brooks comes down with Kenny and they kind of show us the ropes with footings and foundation. So it was great. That got us through the foundation, and then we kind of did our regular framing thing and then evolved over the, you know, the preceding 16 years of developing our own processes and all that. But that was our first interactions with you. Mm-hmm. And so you were a framing contractor for Rivendell Homes.
That's right. Yeah.
Back then.
Yeah.
And how long did you do that for with them?
I would have been about 5-6 years.
Okay.
For sure. On and off.
And I think it was similar.
I didn't just work for them exclusively. I worked for other companies.
And how long before, how long were you working for Rivendell before we got there?
About a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Built a
same thing with Kenny.
Smaller ones on Holden Road. Yeah. So Kenny, I hired him when I took on the previous two houses prior to HH5.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, back in those days, you know, we were all. I mean, I think you're 3 years older than me.
Right? I'm 48. I'll be 49 this year.
Okay. I'm 45 this year. Okay. Yep. So back then, I think I would have been. You would have been close to 30, I guess, and I would have been 25-ish or something. New families, little kids. Mm-hmm. I think I was just about to have kids or
sounds
had
right.
one by then.
Yep.
And it was interesting because there was a little bit of, over that, that following year or so, I started hearing things about Brooks that I didn't know. Like, I knew you as a good builder. I knew that the way you conduct yourself on the site, like, I just had nothing but positives to say about you. But over the following years, I heard little things about you.
All and good, right?
All good, actually. So the things I heard, and I wasn't aware of what degree, but I'd heard that, yeah, Brooks is quite an athlete. He grew up doing lots of sports and stuff, and he played a lot of hockey, which is very, very common around here. Played hockey. He was a decent golfer, I'd heard. Again, I know a lot of people that golf. And just because someone golfs a lot means nothing. There's golf. Most people, what's a standard handicap for your average golfer?
Probably 15.
Yeah.
17.
15 to 20. So like high teens is like a decent place for plays quite a bit. And then you have like low handicappers, which are like, you know, single digits typically. And then you get scratch golfers who shoot par. If you guys aren't golfers, what a handicap means is how many strokes over par. So par for a golf course typically is 72 shots. And so however many shots you shoot over par kind of equates to your handicap, rough and dirty.
Yep.
So we'll talk more about that in a minute, but I heard that you were a golfer, you played motocross, you did motocross, you raced motocross, and you were a legitimate builder. So these are these things I'd kind of heard from time to time, and there would be little things said from people that knew you. I'm like, oh no, he's really good. I'm like, okay, great. I don't know what that means, to what degree. There's things, I grew up playing a lot of sports, and I was decent at things amongst our peers, but I lived in tiny, like the pool of people we're talking about is minuscule.
Yeah.
Right. So like, I was decent at things growing up.
Yeah. When you're at top of the food chain of a town of 300 people,
right?
You know, that's, you walk around that town, you're like pretty, you know, and then you go
So we were kids in Headley.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where you guys grew up in Headley.
That would have been till
92.
Like yes.
About.
Yeah. About 90, early 90s.
You would have done most of your sports and stuff in Carameas.
We did stuff in Carameas. But we weren't into sports much then, because I think we left there when I was about 12, and then we went to the Gulf Islands after that.
Yeah, we were full out. Just straight up redneck in Headley. Like every day was just, you played up in the mountains, and everybody just collected junk in Headley. And so for kids, it's like you just have junk to play with. Just, like you're just
nonstop.
It was such a rad place to grow up as a kid. As long as you get out before the teenage years, because then it dives trouble. Off and there's trouble, right?
Trouble. Yeah.
So that was our
trial. And the Gulf Island story. Where's Gulf Island? Where are you guys?
We were on Thetis Island, which is right across from Chemainus. Yeah. So I went to high school, both Brad and I went to school in Chemainus and took the ferry every day. And again, we went from Headley of 350 people behind a gas station to Thetis Island, that is about the same permanent residence. And there's no town. It's just houses scattered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We grew up there and graduated and then traveled and stuff afterwards.
Went to school in Chemainus. And so that was, so we would have played sports against, like Nanaimo, Couch and Duncan.
Whole area.
So you currently are a realtor.
Yes.
And you've been doing that now for 10 years?
Yeah, it would be about 13, I believe. 2011, I got licensed. I got into it. I followed my dad's footsteps there. He was an owner broker for Coldwell Banker, and he got into real estate in the 80s. So I was always exposed to that. And I am currently licensed today, and that's still what I do. But it was, I was still doing both back then because I wasn't 100% sure whether I was going to just strictly become a realtor or stay as a builder. It was just kind of an option, and there was a transition there. And essentially, I'm 95% realtor now.
That seems really, really common. Like most people I know of that are realtors, it was kind of like a side hustle thing that kind of developed alongside another career as you kind of phase in and develop reputation. That seems pretty common.
Yeah, for sure. But what it does, being a builder and as a background, as a realtor, I mean, you build the houses, now you sell them. So you understand every portion of the house. You know, what walls can be renovated, cost of renovations and so on and so forth. So it becomes a very valuable tool
for sure
to your client, your buyer or your seller.
And that was what you were doing. So you were legitimately building the houses that you were selling. So you would build it yourself or you'd hire a crew and then you would sell that home?
No, not necessarily. No, I mean, just like if I was representing you, Brad, to go and buy a house and you didn't understand the, you know, obviously the process or whatnot, you'd be like, hey, I'd love to widen this kitchen, or I'd love to build a garage here or whatever. I could, you know, you got that skill set that you can help you through the process, right? So it's an invaluable skill because not too many realtors have that ability, right? So it was a nice transition.
Well, you think of the stereotypical mentality of most tradesmen. They're not the greatest people person most of the time.
Right.
That's usually they're like, I don't know. It's interesting. There's in the trades, you're kind of stereotypical tradesmen. Oftentimes, I think is overly confident. There's a ton of arrogance and 100%. Covering a lot of insecurity.
Yeah,
I think.
I agree.
And most guys I talk to, which is kind of sad, say like, I never made as much money or was as happy as when I was working by myself.
Right.
I just can't stand other people. And I hired all these people this one time and it was just a hot mess and it was nothing but headaches and a bunch of idiots. Like that's your stereotypical kind of frame of mentality oftentimes.
Exactly. And they expect you, like they're like, well, I can't believe you don't know that.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much of that. And it's just like, okay, not everybody's as smart as you out there on the job site. Not everybody does it the way you do it. You know, there's other ways to do it. Maybe you should, you know, look outside the box. But you're right. You stereotypical. You come across it all the time.
Yeah. So hearing that you went and moved into realty, I'm like, oh, geez, that for Brooks, that makes so much sense. I mean, your background, your knowledge. And again, like I mentioned before, your conduct on the site and your ability and comfort just talking to people. Because I mean, the trades can also be a bit of a catch-all for all kinds of like personality dysfunction stuff too.
Right.
Because like, you can go onto a job site and be a valuable laborer and kind of keep to yourself. And that can suit a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure.
But then of course you can also be well-rounded and thrive in that environment as well. Okay. I want to jump back now and kind of go through a history of, so you were actually born in Penticton?
In Penticton,
Been in the Okanagan forever?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, graduated high school from, you know, in 93, that would have been it. And I couldn't wait to get out of town, but I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't have the best kind of direction right out of high school. I didn't know what to do. So my parents sent me, they said, if you're not going to school, if I could go back, I would.
Yeah.
You got to get a job. You're not, you know, you can't just stay and live here in the, at the house. Right. So I ended up 2 weeks out of high school with a pair of steel-toed boots and a pouch and up in Prince George. Oh, and that was my first job.
Wow.
Laboring, building a 12-unit townhouses.
Okay. And you hadn't done any of that in high school?
Not a clue.
Okay.
And holy smokes, did I get my eyes open, because, you know, out of grade 12, you know everything. You're good to go. I'm making, I think, $8.50 an hour, packing 10-foot concrete forms in the summertime. It was just like, this is the worst life ever. Jeez. Like, I just couldn't believe it. Now, the gentleman that hired me is actually from Penticton. And so we finished this project. I learned a lot. And his name was Clay. And he says to me, he's like, what are you doing? I said, I don't really know. And he's like, okay, well, I'm going to sign you up as an apprentice. So that is literally how it started. And he came back to Penticton. I'm like, this is perfect. I got to come back and work for him in Penticton. We built a bunch of homes around here. I'm still great friends with him today. Talked to him last week. And we, worked together for quite a long time. Great carpenter, old school. You know, yelling and screaming and you know, running around and getting things done, because that's just the way it was. Right. So I was very fortunate to learn to build under him for sure.
So you started out of high school. So you were what, 17, 18?
Yeah.
And 17, you started,
18, yeah.
And you started your apprenticeship that year?
When I was 18. Yeah.
That's awesome. And then I know we were talking earlier and you did your last 2 years back to back and you were ticketed done by the time you're 21.
Yep.
That's amazing. That's
Yeah, it was. I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to get it done that quick, and that, you know, my journeyman was offering me the apprenticeship just like that. It just worked out very, very well.
I mean, he obviously saw something in you. Like, again, not many guys are going to sit there and say, "Hey, I'm going to do this for you." Like, I'm assuming you guys probably built a bit of a relationship. You saw your work ethic and thought, "Okay, you need to."
Maybe he saw that, but I didn't see it from him, because he was just, like I said, he was old school. And I thought, this guy just hates me, right? Because he's just yelling at me to run up and get going and do this and do that. And I was like, oh, my God, this is crazy. What am I doing? But obviously, that's just
well, you probably weren't giving him a bunch of attitude. You
barely any at all.
So he's probably like, okay, this kid's doing what I'm yelling at. So yeah,
if you know, he was sitting there, and he could probably tell you a few stories about that, right? Yeah. Just like, oh my goodness, like look at this guy, hair down to here.
Yeah.
Okay, so the hair down to there actually is a perfect segue into your teen years. Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about playing hockey.
Yeah.
So when did you start playing hockey, and to what degree?
I think it was probably, right away, 5-6 years old, I think I got into the hockey, and I loved it. I loved hockey. My dad was a hockey player. It was just kind of in the blood and all the mm-hmm. friends and whatnot. So, I played like development hockey all the way through. It's interesting. In, I'd say, grade 9, there was a new sport that came out. It was known as snowboarding. Hmm. And I was a late grower, like height-wise, right? Mm-hmm. And weight. And so I was getting thrown around in hockey a little bit back mm-hmm. then. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to get into the snowboarding. And I could see it in my dad's eyes, right? But he was fully supportive. He was like, okay, if that's what you want to do. So I actually did that for like 3 years. And then I missed hockey. So I went back to playing hockey. So I didn't play for 3 years. I went out and made the AAA team the first year back, right? Mm-hmm. Just because I just loved hockey, right? So it was very cool to do the snowboarding thing and whatnot, mm-hmm. but I did miss the hockey and I ended up going back to that. So yeah, development hockey all the way through. And, you know, I knew that I could go play junior, but I knew I didn't have what it took to get to the next level, and then of course other things get into the way, such as work and mm-hmm. responsibility at that time, right?
Back to the snowboarding, are you so like, are we talking like single tip, you know, like with the V in the back, or like what?
The original Burton. Yeah. I had my first board was a barefoot freestyle, and by the freestyle I think the back lip was about an inch.
Yeah. Just enough. So if you did end up sliding that way by accident,
you might not catch it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And was there no snowboard boots back then? Was it just,
my first pair was a pair of Sorels. Yes. And then I took
totally
ski boot liner.
Okay.
Put it
okay.
in, gave you a little bit more.
So sport. Oversized Sorels with ski boot liners.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Yeah. That was deluxe.
Yeah.
Well, right. I remember. So when we were in Headley as kids,
my
dad ran a camp, and he did all kinds of wilderness skills stuff. And we'd have groups in, and we'd take them skiing at Apex. So I was like, 8 years old, 8-10 years old, and I would assist my dad. Mm-hmm. So we'd have these groups in of a dozen people, and then we'd go ski Apex, and I'd get to join him. And then in the evenings, we'd come down and we'd watch old Warren Miller ski films.
Oh, yeah.
And that was when snowboarding was starting to come out. And yeah, I remember so clearly these like goofy, super straight snowboards with the point, the V at the back, Sorel boots, and the long straps flapping around.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They had the safety straps, and my goodness, they were just...
And then I think our first board before actual snowboard was that yellow kind of snowboard thing with the string on the front.
Oh, yeah.
And we would hold on to that yellow thing, and we go down Hospital Hill in Headley, and we would just fly down there. And again, there's not edges on it, right? It was a plastic rounded thing. But I mean, you were doing the mono ski before that.
In that era when snowboarding was coming out, the other thing that was I thought was the coolest was the mono ski, mm-hmm. where it was like basically like the snowboard and the side by side ski boot bindings.
Yeah.
I thought that was that was all it.
The
chest.
Awesome. Yeah. No helmets back then.
No, of course not.
No,
we're still here.
So with the oh man, yeah, life is hard. Get a helmet. So one thing I was wanting to make the correlation between was, I'm curious to what degree the resilience of being a hockey player, the hard work and the hard nature of that sport, mm-hmm. how that translates into resilience that you have working with in trades, in construction, right? Like there's mm-hmm. got to be a side of that. I mean, I'm probably going to offend a bunch of listeners here, but I'm not a big soccer football, what do we call it? Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge soccer fan. And what drives me nuts about it is the diving and the
acting. It's acting.
Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. insane. And so there's all these, these clips that you see in social media of like a soccer player, and they show the slow motion replay, mm-hmm. doesn't get touched, or it's in basketball with LeBron or whoever. They, something comes close and they writhe and lay on the ground like they've broken a limb, and they get the call. And then they go to Ovechkin standing behind the boards Puck smashes him in the face. He spits out a tooth, looks around, and just stands. I'm like, man, I love that.
Yeah.
And if you dive in hockey, you get a penalty.
Oh, totally.
Like, it's like, and it's not even like an obvious one. They're like, I think if you embellish at all, penalty.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, and that's not even the worst. It's all the other players and even your teammates will look at you and just be like, exactly. What are you doing? Get up, man. Like, don't do that.
Yeah.
So would you attribute any of that development through hockey and the toughness? And like personally, when mm-hmm. when I watch hockey and I'm seeing guys getting these, you know, cross checks in the back, I'm like, oh, I didn't play hockey. I did some martial arts and other things that, you know, required some self-discipline and dealing with discomfort, but never to that degree. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, that takes a special kind of mental strength to not let that get under your skin.
Yeah. Hockey certainly is a physical game. Both mentally and physically, right? You have to pursue and get through so much more than just having skill. Mm-hmm. Like there's the mental side of it, there's the physical side, and then you've also got your teammates. And so there's lots of ups and downs. There's a mental toughness, you know, getting beat up constantly or letting your teammates down, and you learn to, you know, communicate and teamwork. And then the physical side can work into an emotional side. Like hockey is a very emotional game. Mm-hmm. And that's why you're seeing, you know, fighting and huge body checks and whatnot. That's somebody getting fired up or trying to fire their team up and whatnot. Right. Mm-hmm. So,
what kind of player were you and what position did you play?
Definitely physical, left winger. I had really decent speed and a really good shot. So I was more of a forward, definitely smaller, physical side.
Being smaller, like you said, did that put a bit more of a chip on your shoulder? Like I have to be faster and play harder mm-hmm. to be able to. Yeah. And then I guess my other question would be like, you talk about teammates and whatnot, but what about the coaches? Are these like big guys that are screaming and yelling expected a lot? And are we these like mentor, nice, gentle guys, or is it kind of a mix of all that?
Definitely a mix. You know, some were yellers, screamers, and some of them knew how to motivate each particular player differently. Sure. Right. And where other ones would come into the dressing room after being down 3-0 after one and come in and kick the garbage can and just mm-hmm. lose his mind. Right. And that's how he figured to motivate him. But the best coaches I found, and I got into coaching for 10 years of my kid all the way through, was to coach them, you know, as a team, but also what makes Luke tick or what makes Brad tick, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And that I found was you would get the best result for them mm-hmm. from them.
Yeah.
Right. So there's different, I mean, when I was a kid growing up, the coaching was definitely a lot different. It was, mm-hmm. you know, like the Wild Wild West compared to like now there's so many parameters in place and so on and so forth. So it's really, hockey just teaches you so much. Like, you know, as a player and as a human, you know, mm-hmm. you get teamwork, you learn how to control your own emotions, or, you know, you can lose your mind out there mm-hmm. if you have to. And sometimes that's what you had to do, right?
Yeah. Well, because I think a lot of the coaching, though, that's one thing that, not that I agree with the old Wild Wild West, but in a way, when a kid is able to go through that mm-hmm. and, you know, overcome that, you know, and then you say you're going to be a construction worker, or you're going to work in the trades or whatever afterwards, mm-hmm. but you've actually learned how to take all that stuff. I think today there's almost a lack of that mm-hmm. as they're growing up, and you have to be so careful. And then these kids are coming onto the site so entitled mm-hmm. and it's like, hang on a second here, you know? So there's I'm not saying that I'm all for that old school way, but there is a certain chunk of that. I think that does help out a lot. But again, depending on the kid, because I'm like my son on that hand, if you were to, you know, freak out and scream, like it would crush him. And it would destroy him. He needs that someone to be like, okay, who's this kid, and work with him within those parameters. Whereas another one, you know, like that's mm-hmm. not going to work. You need to be hard on them for them to, yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And like I say, everything's different, but toughness, right? Like you had to work through injuries, right? And it didn't help anybody by, you know, whining about it or whatnot. You just sucked it up and you had to get it done, right? So, and on the job site, it's not much different. Mm-hmm. Right. Like there's lots of injuries. You're always banged up, bleeding. If you weren't bleeding, you know, then you weren't working hard enough.
Yeah.
That was kind of like how it was back then. Right.
Mm-hmm. Especially doing concrete.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. So much just blood and grease. This is a great concoction.
It's and just mix it all in there. Right. Oh boy.
Okay. So in your hockey world, mm-hmm. I want to hear, a low moment, maybe like a brutal loss or a bad injury, and then like the like game winning highlight of your life? Like, what are your kind of your high and your low of those?
So that's pretty interesting. I wouldn't say there is actually a particular moment that would be my high point. Sure, getting hat tricks, or you know, I scored 3 goals one time in one shift. I actually still have the sheet at home, and it was like 1 minute and 2 seconds. I scored 3 goals.
That's awesome.
Like, and then so they gave me the sheet because it was one shift, right? Yeah. Like, so skill wise or whatever, that would have been like kind of my high point. But I think overall, what hockey has given me was the coaching aspect of it. Like, I learned the game obviously at a pretty young age, coaching my kids, both of them, and I coached my son the whole way through. I've made such an amazing relationship with all these kids. I still see them in the street. Hey, Coach Brooks, you know, and it's, how you doing? You know, and I have a relationship with these guys for literally ever, right? When Grady's, that's my son, they were coming to their last year of minor hockey. That's when a lot of the kids actually drop off and do other things. And I had half a dozen of them come saying, I'm not playing next year unless you're coaching. Right. And I'm like, whether or not that's true, I don't know. But I said, I'm coaching, and the whole team came back. Right. So it was like, you know, that's
pretty
to
awesome.
Me is a high point as far as, you know, I'd rather do that than score 3 goals in 1 minute, 2 seconds. Right.
Yeah.
Low point, I think, would have been when I kind of decided to quit playing, you know, hockey in grade 9. I wish I never did, but I mean, there's so many things we could wish we could go back and do.
Yeah.
But to come back, you know, in grade 12 is when I came back and played hockey, made the AAA team again. Well, all of a sudden I was like 6'3", right? And I'm like, oh, all these guys were pushing me around. I'm like, okay, this is actually kind of fun now. I'm like throwing them around, right? Remember that, you know? But so that would have been kind of the only downside to hockey. There was never really a particular player. I never had a really horrible injury in hockey or anything like that, other than lumps and bumps.
Do you have brothers and sisters, siblings?
I have an older sibling, yeah. Brother, yeah. He played sports too, but he was not terribly. He was a hard worker, let's put it that way.
Were you guys competitive?
Like, he's six years older than me. So,
okay.
Yeah, having an older brother and playing against, you know, bigger, stronger, and him and all his friends, I think actually really helped me, you know, because you're working with or playing with, you know, guys that are bigger, stronger, faster. Yeah, basically at that point. Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. So,
and when did motocross, explain that to me a little bit. When did that
take place? I got my first dirt bike when I was 12. And it just grew on me. I mean, it wasn't even so much just the riding of it. I actually liked mechanics. I liked to learn how these 2-stroke motors worked. And so it was just like, that was my toy. Like, I got a big boy toy. And, you know, I just started getting involved with other riders in the communities. And all of a sudden, you know, you find out there's these races. And I'm competitive by nature. And I just loved it. So, yeah, I got into doing a bunch of enduro racing, not so much track racing, like supercross or motocross track. Although I did, had a horrible injury on that side where I, like 60 feet to flat and crushed my collarbone into my neck. And, you know, it was just spitting blood for a week. Like, it was horrible.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know what? I kind of like the enduro better. It's more technical, I guess you could say. You know, you're jumping logs and through rivers and hill climbing and all that. So
it's backcountry trail riding?
Yeah, we call it single track, essentially, right? So there'll be 40, 50, 60 riders, you know, 3 or 4 different divisions. And you'll ride for 20-30K, and depending on how many laps or whatnot, and that's up and down the valley. We have some really incredible single track enduro riding around here, and especially out here in Summerland. Like, you can go all the way to Brent Mountain and way in behind Falder, you can go forever. There's some really, really fun stuff and some good riders out here in Summerland.
I went on one few, I don't know, I can't remember what birthday it was. You and Dad bought me a bike, and it was like your classic. I don't even remember what the bike was.
Honda,
do you remember what it
Honda
was?
Honda XR.
Oh, yeah. 100, probably.
As a 5, I think.
Yeah, it was a decent size bike.
Because I had a 650, and I think I got you a 5.
Yeah.
Those are big bikes.
Yeah, I got a picture of it at my big station bikes, in the shop.
Heavy.
And so it looked beautiful. It was something that, like, I want to say it was, I don't know if it was Back to the Future. There was one bike. It was like the same color. It was like the classic orange and the blue seat like such a great looking bike. But
like
then
John Connor's bike from Terminator, like that kind of look.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. But I went up with he bought a bike. So, cause we would go do fishing together. So we'd kind of do a bit more probably your enduro style, like go out into the back country, backpack, fishing rods, do that. And then a couple of boys who were more into like proper riding, they took me out up Falder area.
Because we were trash.
Yeah, we were trash. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We rode motorbikes.
You could get from A to B, no problem. But exactly. You're not.
Yeah. I wouldn't say no problem. We'd get from A to B.
Yeah. And then you busted your kickstand that one time and we had to.
My kickstart.
Your kickstart. And then we had to pull. That's a whole other story. Yeah. Anyway. And then so I went up with Falder with a few of these boys and they're. I don't think knew that I had no idea what I was doing back there. And they're doing all these hill climbs and they're going further and further and further. And like, it was so embarrassing because I have to like walk my bike up all these things. And then by the end, they're like, how about you just get off? You hike up this huge hill. We'll ride it up there for you. And then you get on it.
Right.
And then we ended up getting lost up there because the sun went down
mm-hmm.
and only one guy out of the four or five of us had a light.
Yeah.
And so we're like out in the back there with guys who supposedly know where we're going. And so it's pitch black. And again, I don't know what time of night it was. But we finally found a trail that someone's like, I know this trail. This will take us back to whatever. Mm-hmm. And so we followed in the dark. It was terrible. And I've never gone up there since.
Since, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. Funny. Sold the bike, bought a camera.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Like when, you know, again, like we've dirt biked a tiny bit, a little bit. And then you go with people who actually know how to ride.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, this is not the same. At all. Like the we were entry level.
Right.
And so my father-in-law, Gary Swaby is his name, and he was a competitive rider out of Kelowna. And him and his brother were like, they were known in Kelowna back in the 80s. Like if you can keep up with the Swaby boys, mm-hmm. you're a legit mm-hmm. rider. So my wife's uncle John, he rode larger bikes and he would either win a race or he'd crash.
Right.
And couldn't finish. Oh, yeah. Whereas Gary, my father-in-law, he rode smaller bikes and was quite competitive, did really good. He hadn't ridden for years and years and years. So I get my bike and I'm like, hey, I'll borrow a buddy's bike. Well, let's go riding together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's like, this was probably, how long ago was this? He was in his late 50s and we go riding. He hasn't been on a bike for like 15, 20 years. And I'm like, I'm expecting him to still be able to handle himself okay. And this isn't going to be dangerous.
Right.
Well, in no time, I'm trying to get up these stupid little hills and here he's on his back wheel, just putting alongside me up to the top of this ridge, stays his back tire, goes along the top of the ridge and comes down. I'm like, this isn't fair. It's not the same at all. I'm trying not to fall over.
Right.
And you're just looking to make this look so easy.
Like riding a bike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. It's awesome. So we're never going riding together.
No. So just to put that into perspective, I know some of these riders that are insane. Like, so they basically have beginner, intermediate, expert, and then pro. And I was started out in intermediate and ended up being pretty competitive and expert. And I never went pro.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between expert and pro is like NHL and minor hockey. Like because you're racing on the same track or mm-hmm. the same loop. Those guys I try to keep up with and they are, I mean, there's maybe a dozen of them in the Okanagan here, mm-hmm. and they're just on another whole level. Yeah. Like some of the lines that they're taking and whatnot, I'm just like, I didn't even see that.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it's just, there's just that next level.
I watched a few years ago where I witnessed that. And there's maybe like eight, 10 riders or something. And they start, one guy just sits on the start line,
mm-hmm.
just sat there. And I'm sitting in the audience. I don't know what I'm talking about or what I'm looking at. I'm like, what's this guy doing? And there's people sitting around us like, oh, that's so-and-so. He's going to wait till everyone's lapped him and then he'll go.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, how arrogant is this guy? And everyone's, they're flying. I'm like, holy cow, these guys are fast.
Look at
these guys go. Yeah. And then they blow by him and then he gets into it. And I bet you within three laps, he lapped them all and he beat them by a ridiculous margin. And the mm-hmm. way he threw that bike around, it was completely different.
Yeah,
it's like a different sport.
Exactly.
So yeah, cool.
Some people got it, right? Like,
It's crazy that at that elite level, mm-hmm. like I even think of like in hockey and then you say like a McDavid, mm-hmm. when you think of everyone who's already so extremely good.
Right.
And then how can one person be way better than the already extremely top of the world? It's just
making the best players in the world look mediocre.
Yes.
Like when, I don't know if you saw the skills competition with McDavid, it was just like the McDavid show.
Yeah.
And it was like, how, like, you bobbled the puck, but you still beat the fastest guy by 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, it's ridiculous. Next level. So it's exciting to watch.
Though. Oh, it's so fun to watch.
Yeah. So motocross from, you said, grade 9?
It would have been grade 6.
Grade 6? I was like, until yeah. when? When did you kind of stop being competitive with it?
I would say early 30s.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. So you were for a long time.
Oh, yeah. No, I loved that. Like, it was just such a... And the nice thing was the time of year was always open for me because the hockey season was just kind of ending. Golf season hadn't started. It was, you know, spring and fall.
Right.
It was riding season, right? You didn't want to go in the summer because it's too hot and dusty. In the winter, obviously, the snow. So season-wise, it you know, enabled me to do that. But it is a very physical... You know,
I've heard that people talk about like the most
knees and back,
the most like endurance you need for different sports. Like motocross is way up there.
Oh yes. 100%. One, you, like they're probably some of the, you know, most in shape athletes in the world, cardio, strength, everything. And you'll notice like on supercross. Okay. So that's the track that you're seeing, you know, in the arenas and whatnot. Yep. Mm-hmm. Those riders, like I am huge on a bike. Like, you know, you would be too. They're all like 5'5", 5'6". They're like a jockey on a horse.
Okay.
Right? And they're 140 pounds, you know, 5'6". And those are generally
it's funny because like riders. Those are the guys that you think, like when someone's really, really good, you assume they're 6'7".
Yeah.
Right? And then you see them in real life and you're like, oh, you're just a little guy. No, it's funny. My ass.
Yeah. Little guys go fast on a bike.
Yeah. That's like Kelly Slater, best surfer in the world, you know, 11-time world champion. I think he's like 5'8" or something like that. But then he's riding some crazy thing, you know, to see these people in real life. You're like, oh, okay.
You're just like the rest of us, but way better somehow.
Yeah, somehow. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Okay. So I'm assuming your low in motocross was smashing your collarbone and spitting blood and all that.
Yeah, that would have been.
Physically speaking.
Yeah, would have been for sure. It was kind of day before I was going on a holiday with my wife to Mexico.
Oh, so you did this when you were married.
Okay, jeez. This isn't young and so stupid. This is like older and stupid.
This, yeah, I was about 28, 29, somewhere in there. This was not good.
So was this just after like I was or before when we were building with us?
Yeah, would have been just after.
So just after you did that project with us.
I was still on HH5, actually. Really? Because I remember being in the shack in my sling. And then that was like, yeah. So the day before I was going on our, wife was not happy.
You do this and then hospital. And if this went into your neck, is this like a surgery plates? Like what was the deal?
No, he just kind of, they just kind of put it in a position. Like pull it out and put it into position. It was very excruciating. I can tell you that much. Like you break your arm, you're in a cast, right? And they set it and it basically set it and forget it. Yep. Collarbone is just like, it's like a rib. It's just like the worst because you can't set it. So you can't sleep, you're in a sling and then it, you know, it starts healing and then you move and you can hear it clicking and cracking. You know, it's just like, it was a horrible injury just because you can't sleep, can't move, can't.
Yeah,
do anything. So exactly. So that was kind of like the all right.
Did you go to Mexico in a sling or did that cancel the whole trip?
No, I went. Okay. Oh, I was going. It's not a big deal. You know, it's no big deal. So I made the best of it. But it was like, okay, you know, it's kind of impacting your professional career at some point. You know, you're not getting paid for this.
Yeah.
It's you're having fun and whatnot. So that was kind of like the beginning of the end. I mean, I did ride for a few more years, but
so was there prize money involved in any of these races or was it more trophy?
Only in the professional. Like if you went to professional, then you would collect money. But you get podium. Like, I was on the podium or whatever. You get your picture, you get your medal and you get, gift card at Honda or whatever for a couple $100. You buy yourself a new tire, or set of brakes or whatever. Gotcha. Right.
Yeah.
But it was just being competitive, like the competition. And it's an organized race versus you and your buddies going up in the bush. Yeah. I mean, which is still great too, but it's nice to, like I say, I'm competitive by nature. I want to know, I want to beat you. I want to see where I fit in here, right? And that's,
it's great.
It was, for sure.
Is there any particular highlight?
You know, there's just so many.
Yeah.
There truly is, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't believe that you actually had a lap time of this or that,
right.
Or you know, picked the perfect line. Like there's just,
okay, I'm going to,
there's, instant gratification and some little things in that sport, because it's so fast. It's adrenaline, right?
Yeah. I'm just going to kind of drop one in here spontaneously that's going to make you really happy. In my kind of sports, not a career, endeavors, you know, there's a variety of things. You know, I've become a golfer, so there's some highlight moments with golf. But what came to mind to me as like this like pinnacle moment was surfing with you in Raglan.
Yep.
At what beach? At the farm.
Oh, in Australia.
Australia. Right. Yeah. And so Brad was big into surfing. It's going to sound like a lot and I'm a pathetic surfer. I've been well over 100 times, which is like nothing.
Yeah.
I've been, got myself wet and I've paddled a ton. Yeah. But there was a wave that I caught that was like perfect and it lasted forever.
Oh,
it was just like this, like
no better feeling.
Oh man. It's so great. I've caught, you know, a variety of rides, but there was one that just nothing compares to, like as far as a athletic kind of sporty moment that was just like euphoric.
That feeling is so good. Right.
Well, it was so nice because I remember being out and, you know, and I'm catching waves and having a lot of fun, and Luke's come here and he's come all the way to Australia and he's got this board and he's seeing me catch his rides, and it's his younger brother and he's watching it. And Luke always has been like a better athlete. He's taller, faster, not as good looking, but he's obviously like, so then there's that part. So I'm sitting out there and this nice wave comes and I'm watching and I'm seeing paddle. I'm like, oh, he's in a good spot. He's paddling pretty hard. I'm like, well, I don't know if he's going to catch it. And if he does catch it, is he going to be able to get up? And is he going to be able to make the, you know, set the rail and turn and actually go? And so the wave came and it was big enough where, I mean, it was probably just overhead.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest waves, maybe the biggest I've ever caught.
Yeah. And so I just see kind of like the whitewash trail from behind the wave, and I kind of see his head and then it just disappears. And so I'm watching it and the wave's peeling behind and I'm just watching. And then I see his head kind of bob up.
So you're like,
yeah. And then I see it disappear again. And I see it kind of come up and then disappear. And then he pulls over the back of the wave. Like it was fully ended. And he's just like, hands up, best moment, look on his face. Yeah. And I felt almost just similar to what he felt. I'm like, you just had
like
the feeling. Similar probably to, I'm curious, like you said, when you pick the perfect line or you do it's only those, you can't really explain it. There's a feeling and something that happens in that moment that just, you're like, I have to do that again.
Yeah.
That's what makes you keep coming back.
That's exactly
keeps coming back.
Yeah. 100%. And that's the same kind of level, just different sport, right?
Yeah, sure.
That's what keeps you going out. Yeah. It's no different than in golf. When you hit, you could play like garbage all day. Mm-hmm. And then you hit a shot on 18 and you're like, oh my, I love this game. I'm coming back. Funny. Right. Yeah. But for 17 holes prior to, you're just like, I'm done. I'm throwing these clubs out. Like, you know, I see it all the time with other people.
I tried to play Monday mornings yesterday on 18 on our course.
Yeah.
Piped a drive, my best drive maybe ever on 18.
Nice.
So I hit this perfect power fade and I had a par five, I had 155 left of the flag.
Holy doodle.
So I'm like, oh my goodness. I had a good round and then I chunked my nine, pulled it left, and I chunked two chips I three putt for a bogey.
So a bogey with 155 in. So that's kind of the other end of the spectrum where you're like,
yeah.
You had a good day.
Yeah, going. I still shot 75. I was really happy with, but there was a few moments like that was going really good. You just totally.
Well, you think, you know, you knock it on there with your 8-iron or whatever, and maybe you make the eagle and you're shooting 72, 73.
That's right. Yeah.
It's funny. I think of golf in the construction world and I could be wrong, but I want to say that you two guys are a little bit of anomalies in guys that play golf and do construction. Not that there's not. But when I think of the majority of guys that I've worked with over the years, and there's been tons, like, I don't know, however many, very few can I remember that actually play golf on a regular basis and are any good. I would say the majority of the guys, like they play hockey, they play slow pitch. And you know, those are kind of the main things, right? So it's interesting that you guys are so into golf, because I think there's a lot of conversation there that guys are going to be listening to being like, his nine what? And he chunked. What does that mean? And I hit a power fade? What the heck is a power fade? Like, I know, is that like a nice haircut?
Yeah.
Like, what's the, you know? So it's interesting.
Oh, I'm getting my haircut at noon today. I'm going to ask Justin, I want a power fade.
That's right. You know, so I don't know. Is that, would you say that's fairly true? Like, is it?
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I do know a few tradesmen that are golfers, not many.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys who like
more weekend warriors. Is, you know, they load up the cart with 12 beers and go out there, and they don't care if they shoot 80 or 100. They're out having fun, right?
And sometimes Luke will treat a few of the guys like, hey, we're going to go golfing, you know, and it's hilarious. You go out there, probably have a couple beers. That might be the best part of the thing. And then they loosen up. But I mean, they're swinging as if they're swinging a hammer at the ball or it's a hockey stick or a baseball, you know? It's a good time, but I don't know if I would call it a laugh.
It's a laugh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or anything. It's great.
It's a nice walk.
Fun.
Yeah. Okay. So as you were describing the different seasons of the different sports, so you had motocross stuff in the spring and the fall, and you had the hockey season, and you touched on golf.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you start golfing, and what has that journey been? Because again, for those of you watching, listening, as I was kind of reaching out to Brooks, we haven't really talked for 10 years or something.
Yeah.
And before then, not much either. So again, I've heard these bits and pieces, had this great kind of memory of our past. Mm-hmm. And then I reached out to kind of get a little bit of a bio and history of your endeavors and things, and had heard good things. And then I thought, we should go golfing and stuff. I should get some idea. I know he's good, but again, good is a very interpretive thing to kind of say about golf. And then, you know, I hear your handicap, and you're currently a +3, plus four. So. So that this makes sense to you, I was talking about handicaps before. Most people are like, you know, say an average decent golfer is a 17. They shoot 17 shots over par, over 72. If you're a plus, you generally shoot that many strokes under par. So that means Brooks shoots on average 67, 68, 66. This morning I looked up your profile. You had two rounds ago. You shot a 63.
Mm-hmm, with a bogey.
Dude.
Yeah, it was I missed like a 3-footer. I was like ready to cry.
And that's what he talks. There's golf for you.
Yeah.
You shoot 63 and he talks about the bogey, the 3-foot putt. Yeah,
and you know what's so funny, because you don't think about all the good shots.
Yeah.
Like obviously I made some good shots that day and rolled some putts, but you always think about
the bogey. What was that?
That's the way it is.
That was Penticton. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay, so when did you start playing golf?
Yeah, so I was probably 12. 13 years old. Grew up on the West Bench, right? Which is just above the golf course, right? My parents were members there. I wasn't really into golf, but I started hanging around there. And
you're playing hockey at this time?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then, but then springtime come, hockey comes to an end, and then it's springtime. I started hanging around the golf course, and I just kind of knew a couple of the kids that were picking the range, right? With the shag bags or the tractor. And I started hanging out with them. Mm-hmm. Basically having, you know, a club and helping them pick the range. Mm-hmm. And that's literally how I started it. And I think it was the tractor or the cart, you know, that I got to drive at 12 years old that was really attracting me to the golf course. Right. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they offered me a job and I'm like, I got the best job ever. I get to drive the cart, you know? And then I essentially got into hitting balls and becoming, you know, involved with the junior side of golf at 13 competitively. Like the guys that I all played hockey with, they're on my hockey team, we're golfing now.
That's a pretty common thing I've found out. A lot
it's
of hockey players
of the
are golfers.
Season overlap, right?
Really, that's why. And obviously the physicality, the good physical state that you're in, and the hand-eye coordination. There's a lot of things that translate across that are going to be beneficial. And the mental toughness side.
Oh, that's everything in competitive golf.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you see so many golfers at the elite level. They all hit the ball so, so, so good. It's the mentally tough ones that excel. Mm-hmm. It's 80% of the game for sure, which is just incredible.
Okay, so sorry, I derailed you, but so you're starting to play a little bit of competitive golf with your hockey buddies.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah. And then we got into what they have is a zone two, which is essentially, you know, a Soyuz two Kamloops. They have a junior tour. It's still to this day. My daughter played last weekend in it. And
how'd
she'll be playing this weekend. She was third day one, and she had a really tough day at Fairview Mountain, but, you know, she's learning. Mm-hmm. So we did this kind of junior tour, and the first event that I played in, I ended up with a low net, like overall, you know, and it really just piqued my interest competitively. Mm-hmm. And then I was full bore into the golf after that, like just struck something. And I, you know, played a lot of competitive golf through junior golf for Team BC, you know, representing BC in the, you know, across the nation. Against all the other provinces, and played all the way through until I went up to Prince George right? Out of high school.
Yeah.
And then I didn't pick up a golf club for like 2 years because I was just so involved with life and whatnot. And then my journeyman, Clay, he's like, hey, we should go golfing sometime, right? I'll take you golfing or whatever. When we moved back to Penticton, and then I realized how much I missed it. And he's like, oh my God, you're pretty good, hey? And I'm like, I guess so. Like I wasn't, you know, sure or whatnot. So I actually got right back into the golf and went to a Monday qualifier for a PGA event in Vancouver and qualified first overall. So I shot 67 and I double bogeyed the 16th hole. Right. And I thought, oh, it's my chance. Cause they only take four people out of like 130 people. They qualify for the PGA event. So like, this is literally a year after I started golfing again and I ended up qualifying first. And I'm like, oh, wow. So I got to go to the PGA, the Greater Vancouver Open, known as the Air Canada. And holy smokes, did I get my eyes open there? Right. Like I'm playing with Payne Stewart. He was like my idol growing up. You know, John Daly's there. Mike Weir was like a nobody. He was on the Canadian tour back then. And
that's crazy.
Just some really, like, you know, I go into the locker room. I'm like, holy doodle. This is gonna, like,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was. It was an experience I'll never, ever forget. And it really, you know, I thought maybe this is the path, right? Like maybe this is what I want to do. You know, I'm still in carpentry school. Like I'm literally banging nails like 2 days before the qualifier, you know, on Friday, and I'm racing down to Vancouver and I'm like, oh, this would be quite the life. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I played a lot of competitive golf, up until today. Like I'm going to represent British Columbia May 7th, 8th and 9th. Against Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. They have a Ryder Cup format. So I played and I qualified for this team through the provincials in BC and then the Canadians, which were in New Brunswick last year. So I was actually low player for British Columbia in nationals last year in New Brunswick. So, and I was ranked first for 40 plus year olds. So I'm 48. First in BC. So that's why I qualified for this team. So
that's great.
And then we have a 3-day tournament at Seattle Private Country Club, which is like, I'm really excited to go and that's do, great. Right? So the golf, yeah, I still play competitively. I still love it.
I'm obviously that's professional golf. Like that's like,
it's amateur.
It's still amateur.
Yeah.
And so, being amateur, what does that mean? So like, let's say you win. Is that like, is that money? Is that,
so they just kind of changed the rules. Okay. Like you can now win up to, and it's about $2,000.
Okay.
Without claiming it. As soon as you start claiming money, then you're deemed a professional.
Gotcha.
And then you can't play amateur events. Right. So back when I qualified, you want to talk about highs and lows. So obviously extremely high by qualifying for that PGA event, thinking I'm this good.
Right? You're 21?
Yeah. It would have been 98. So 20, I was 22.
Okay.
So we're, you know, I get to that tournament and then, you know, it starts going through my head and I'm like, well, Mike Weir's playing on this Canadian tour. You know, maybe I should do that. So I looked into that and I have to go out east and qualify. And I've generally got what I've wanted in golf. You know what I mean? Whenever I wanted it, I've kind of got it or made my goals and whatnot. So I went and tried to, they have Q school, qualifying school. It'll be 140 players and they'll take the top 20 and they'll issue you your card for the following year. So you can play all the events across Canada. So I went to this qualifier thinking, you know, I should be pretty good here. I get my card and so on and so forth. Well, I shot the worst round on the first day that I'd shot in like since I was a kid. And you want to talk about mad or upset or whatever. So I shot like an 80, like right on the number. And it was just like devastating. Like I could not believe what happened. So they play two rounds and then they cut and then you play two more if you make the cut. Well, I ended up playing decent the next three rounds and I missed my card by like three or four shots. And it was so, it was just horrible. But it was almost over after day one. Like I had to play extremely well. Yeah. So it was just like, oh, I was so devastated. So ultimate high, you know, 2 weeks before in Vancouver to ultimate low, right? And then that was the tournament in Vancouver was like end of August and then Q school was in October. So I had all winter to sit there and think about, I guess I'm swinging a hammer
instead of a golf club.
So when you're in that place, you're in, so you go there and you realize that you've blown it the first day, you get your 80, which is an amazing.
Most people like you shot.
I'm like, if I don't, I've never got 80. Like that would sound, that's, but again, you do that. What does angry Brooksy do there? Like, what is it like? Are you like, when no one's watching, you're like hucking clubs? Are you like pounding back the juice app? What's the deal? Or are you a pretty calm, like,
I'm pretty
calm guy?
Pretty calm. And you learn that discipline through golf, because getting mad in golf or on the course is never going to help you.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that I love about golf, is it's not a team sport. Like you got nobody to blame but yourself. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're on the bench and the other line lets in the game winning goal for the other team. And it's different. There's nobody to blame but yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, angry Brooksy was probably, oh, I don't know. There was probably a couple words yelled while I was in the rental car by myself. You know, quick vent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, can't believe it. You know, driving back to the hotel room, just running it through your head. And and then by the end of the evening, it'd be like, okay, well, this is the hole that I've dug. Now, how am I going to get out of it? So, you know, what, just to make the cut after shooting an 80 was pretty good. And then, you know, I put in a good showing for the last three rounds, where I could have just like literally given up. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's just not in the cards.
Yeah.
So, angry Brooksy didn't get too mad. As a junior, sure, you banging clubs and whatnot, but you learn. Mm-hmm. Like golf teaches you so much more than just the sport. It's it's the mental toughness. It's the etiquette. It's, you know, you can play with anybody at golf. That's why I love it. You can play till you're 80, 90 years old.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I love about it, right? Like the people that you meet, like we can go and play, and it doesn't matter if you're a 20 handicap, we can play even.
Yeah.
That's how like Luke was saying, that's how the handicap system works. So I love that part of it. It's great for business. I love people and I love helping people golf. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
so I'm not sure if you guys have noticed on the camera on Brooks as he's making gestures, but you're slightly impaired.
With and high, 4.5.
He can count to 9.5, yeah. So I'm assuming that had impact on all of the things that you are passionate about.
Yeah.
In some capacity. So I gotta understand, because how many years ago was this?
It would have been about 2012, November 2012.
Okay, so like 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing through the grapevine that Brooks had an accident on the job site and lost a digit.
Yep.
And I remember people being like, and like his motocross, his golf, hockey, all these things. I mean, like if you lose a thumb, that's a big deal that affects everything.
Yeah.
So I remember it just being this kind of collective gasp of everyone in the industry that was familiar with you, like, oh no. So that was as much as I knew about it. Now hearing and getting context to the level that you were at and the disciplines that you've undertaken, like that's a pretty big deal, I imagine. So can you kind of explain that scenario and then your kind of mental dealing with that in the following years?
So when it happened, I mean, I couldn't believe what had transpired and what had happened. I mean, you've been on the job site. We've all kind of cut corners here and there. I've done way worse things on the job site and never had a problem. You always hear that story. And it happened, and I couldn't believe it. But I ended up in Vancouver for 3 weeks. You know, they sewed it back on, and that's a whole nother story.
Okay, hang on. You got to go back. We need the gory details.
Do you really?
We do.
It's pretty.
No.
If you're willing to share them.
You want the story.
This is our audience.
Because honestly, Brooksy, we had this podcast, I don't know, however many months ago, Dustin, Luke, and this came up. We were talking about when we first started, we talked about Kenny, Feck Bradley. I used to say it all the time. Oh, Feck. And then we're talking about Brooksy and how did, and then this whole thing came up, And Luke kind of retold a little bit of what he'd heard.
Right.
And so there would be some listeners actually that would be like, would this is the guy.
Yeah. Okay. So. All right. So yeah, backing it up. I'm working with my journeyman. We teamed back up and did some work. So working for, on a, building a three car garage for Dave Campy and Penticton. So how was his, you know, Lamborghinis and all his Bentleys and so on and so forth. You know, we got her framed up, trusses are on. And for whatever reason, one of the trusses was like, wasn't planing out. So instead of pulling the nails and sliding that truss over that half inch, I'm like, snap a line on the top cord, rip a quarter off, take that strip, nail it to the other side, and everything planes out fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm standing between trusses, you know, I'm ripping down. And you know, it's a, not a worm drive, normal skill saw.
Okay.
So I'm whipping it down and then I zipped or grabbed with my left hand to zip the kind of the tail off.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So I handcuffed myself.
So you're cutting down with your left hand.
Cutting down, and then I switched to the left just as I'm hanging on to the top of the rafter to zip that kind of last couple feet down, and it bind. Like, I don't know if I hit a knot or whatever. Yep. So, and I was handcuffed, so I couldn't, I didn't have much strength there.
You still had the trigger squeezed?
Yeah. So I'm like, and it bit.
Yeah.
And it like came back and I'm hanging on to the top of the truss and this thing is coming at my face. And of course the weight is on the blade. So the guard can't come down. Right. And it came like, it was coming at my face. And I remember I just kind of went like that. And I was like, tonk. And I didn't even have to look.
You just, I just dropped
put,
it.
So I'm 10 feet up, right? 10 feet up. And I didn't even look. I just, I put my hand under there like that. And I walked off the roof. Like I stepped off. Like just the adrenaline or whatever. It was like nothing. Like I, it was just like a stare.
Like 10 feet.
10 you feet just walked straight off.
And stuck the landing and walked away.
No problem. Like it was, and I yelled at Clay. I'm like, Clay, we got to go. We got to go to the hospital. So
you haven't looked at it still.
No, I'm not looking. Did it feel, I'm not looking.
I imagine it felt like it just an impact. Like
it
a just, good,
like
just a
it was
smack.
Just like it was numb. Yes, that's it. It was like punk.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm just not looking. It could be my hand. I don't even know if my hand, you know what I mean? Like I just,
you just chicken wing it.
Just, I just did that.
No kidding.
Right? I'm squeezing it and I'm just like, I can't feel anything. I don't know. What, I don't know, you know? And I'm yelling. I'm sitting in the truck. Okay, this is you want a gory details.
Yeah, yeah.
So of course, like, you know, I'm up that high. It happens. The saw, which was brand new that day, by the way.
What kind of saw was it?
Yeah, it was a DeWalt. Didn't like it. I've never, ever. I'm a Makita guy.
He's all DeWalt. Like he's all like, DeWalt.
If I didn't cut my thumb off, I'd probably, you know, DeWalt, but I'm not anymore. Anyway, so this thing, you know, obviously falls and smashes on the slab. My vehicle's about 15 feet away and I'm in the passenger seat and I'm kind of just assessing what's going on. I'm yelling at Clay. He doesn't even know what's going on. I'm like, hospital, hospital. Now we got to go, you know, and he's like, oh my God, what's going on? Anyway, I'm looking at the saw that hit the ground and I'm like, okay, am I getting into shock? And I'm like, I think I see my thumb in the outfeed, you know, the exhaust outfeed, right? I'm like, oh no, I must be in shock. Right. And I'm looking, I'm like, I think that's my thumb in there. I'm like, oh no. Anyway, so we drive to the hospital, right? And I get to the hospital and I'm still kind of like this and I'm just trying to remain calm, you know, and so on and so forth. And there's this, bless her heart, 90-year-old lady in the emergency lineup. Excuse me, I think I missed my appointment yesterday. And can somebody, my doctor is such and such. And I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Excuse me, ma'am. Like, you actually have an emergency here. You know? So she kind of went to the side and whatnot. And then the nurse, I remember sitting there just like this. And the nurse finally come out. And she's like, so what's happened? You cut your hand pretty bad or whatever. I'm like, yeah, I think it's pretty bad. And she's like, well, I got to see it. And I'm like, no. She's like, well.
Are you bleeding down your side?
Yeah, like, there's blood there, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I got to see it. And so I didn't look and I kind of put my hand out like this and she opened it up and then she closed it just like that. She's like, yeah, it's gone. I'm like, Clay, it's in the saw. Go get my thumb. Go get my thumb. It's in the saw. I saw it. He drove all the way back.
How far away was it? Like 20 minutes?
No. Because he's just down. It's 7 minutes.
Okay, it's close by. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, they get me in, you know, they get me in the stretcher. Clay leaves. He's going to get my thumb. So they get me in the, you know, on the bed and whatnot and give me a couple of Ativan or whatever. I don't even know what it was. Yeah. It calmed me down. And
They bandage it all up.
The pain, and yeah, they're just assessing what's going on, like how bad is his thumb or whatever. So Clay goes to the job site and pried it out with a 3-inch common. He pried my thumb out, picked it up and put it in a plastic bag and drove it to the hospital.
Yeah.
How much of your thumb?
So it's cut right below the knuckle.
Okay.
So yeah. I mean, I got really big thumbs, but yeah. So it was cut right below the knuckle. And I'm just, so now I'm kind of out of it a little bit. And he brought the thumb back and they're like, we're sending you to Vancouver. We're going to sew this thing back on. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is kind of weird, you know? Mm-hmm, yeah. So they literally threw the bag with my thumb and a bunch of ice and just put it on my chest as I'm laying, waiting for the ambulance. Oh, I'm serious. And I'm like, what?
You could, there's like, my thumb.
There's
in
my
bag.
Thumb in this. Yeah. Like, it was
and you
just
already
insane.
Didn't want to look at it. You're like, I'm not looking at it. And then
so
they
now
put
I'm
it
looking,
on your chest.
It was a nice clean cut. The blade was obviously really sharp.
Good job.
Yeah, it was good. It was good cut. But
so not flown, they ambulance you to Vancouver?
So, well, this is a whole nother thing. So they're supposed to fly me out of Penticton. And then, like I said, I'm a bit out of it. But I hear them talking and they're like, well, they're painting the runway at Penticton, so no planes are landing. Got to go to Cologne. So they ambulanced me all the way to Kelowna, and that's when that rock slide happening right now. Right. That was the original time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Before anyway, the highway was built.
The new one.
While they were building it, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, they flew me or ambulanced me all the way to Kelowna.
Did they have to go around the other side of the lake then?
No, okay, they got through, okay. Right? Flew me to Vancouver, VGH, Burn and Trauma Ward, and they sewed this bad boy back on. And use leeches and like it was
really.
Oh yeah.
What do you mean they use leeches? What do you mean?
So your venous blood, right, which is oxygen deprived. So when they sew it back on, there's a bunch of scars here. They actually pulled arteries and veins and put it in there. They use the leeches to suck out the venous blood, which is oxygen deprived. So the leeches suck all the dirty blood out essentially, mm-hmm. and the new stuff pumps in, and that's how you're
Jeez.
How it comes back. So I was there for 2 weeks. They were checking my dressings every hour. So like it was quite an operation. And it was kind of fun putting on these leeches and stuff and watching this thumb come back to life. And it did to within 1 day of them sending me home. They're like, you know what? We're going to send you home. It looks like everything's good to go. We're sending you home tomorrow.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the worst part of it all. The following night, there's like, say, they're supposed to check on me every hour. There was a shift change. And then one of the nurses came back from a holiday after 2 weeks. And she never checked on me at all that final night. Like, obviously, she thought I was through the woodwork or whatever, right? She never checked. And I built relationships with these nurses, right? I mean, it was super awesome and so unreal there. I wake up in the morning. She finishes her shift, this new gal. Mm-hmm. And then the other nurses come in. They're so happy. We're sending you home. You know, like they did such a great job. Mm-hmm. And they open up my bandage. And I guess when I fell asleep, I squished the blood flow again. And they literally pulled the bandage off. And it was like dark and black again.
No.
The nurse started crying.
No.
Right? Because they'd worked so hard. And then so we tried to bring it back a second time and whatnot. And it just didn't take. So I stayed there another week. And it was literally mummified at the end. Because I'd take a needle and prick it. No. To get blood to come out, and then that's how you get the leeches to get on there. And there was no blood. So brutal. All that work, you know, I felt sorry for the nurses, really. At the end of the day, I don't know if it would have been worse or better.
Right.
Because would I be able to bend it? Would I be catching it on things? Like,
right.
Considering, you know, I had a lot of time, obviously, in that hospital bed thinking, like, am I going to be able to play with my kids? Am I going to be able to shoot a basketball? Am I going to be able to hold a golf club? Can I shoot? Like, just all those unknowns, right? Can I grab a cup or whatever? And I'm really fortunate. Like, that could have been so much worse because there's some challenges. Like, doing up buttons and stuff is really kind of hard.
Yep.
You know, your shirt buttons and so on.
But, picking your nose.
Yeah.
But any advantages, anything like any advantages you got it, you know, like maybe even just,
I'm
like,
not winning any thumb wars. I mean, I don't like
no special treatment,
any advantages, not particularly.
No upside.
no upside. And really the downsides are very, very minor. Yeah. There's some adjustments and whatnot, but I can shoot the puck still. I can still golf. I can still shoot a basketball and, you know, tie shoes and swing a hammer or whatever needs to be done. So it could have been so, so much, you know, worse. And it also changed the path of my professional career. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what got me into the brokering and the real estate and everything. So life-changing moment. Mm-hmm. Quite a story. Like, I mean, there's, I mean, there's so many people that are in way worse condition. And I saw that at the Vancouver Burn and Trauma Ward. There was some people in there and I'm like, you know, quite fortunate for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. That gives you, I mean, a good perspective again, just on, you know, what's really, really important. You know, like my wife works a little bit with the kids through a church and there's a bit of a youth gathering at our place a couple nights ago. And one of the things they talk about is like the highs and lows of their week. Mm-hmm. And I was in the kitchen doing some other things, poking around. And I was hearing the lows that everyone's talking about of their week, these high school kids.
Right.
And I at one point, like, you guys, these are such first world lows. Yeah. My goodness.
Not even a problem.
Like, not at all. And we just had a big laugh. Like, it wasn't any serious criticism, but I'm like, we are so damn spoiled.
Right.
You know, and then when we are inconvenienced by these minor trivial things mm-hmm. and it becomes the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And then something like that is far more substantial because it does affect your day to day and your perspective on things. But again, in the grand scheme of things, it is so, so petty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think of the mental toughness of like on what's needed on the job site when things are difficult, when you're playing a sport and it's competitive and it's hard and you're hard on yourself. And I think what so oftentimes is kind of the strategy to deal with it properly is keeping things in proper perspective.
Yep.
Like, you know what? It really doesn't matter. You know, I still want to be respectful to the people that I'm responsible to. I still want to conduct myself well. Like there's a lot of things that still really matter, but my perspective on it, if I zoom out, you know, I'll have a far better outlook on things and be far more of an asset and far more of an optimist if I'm just realistic with the implications of the difficulty that it seems so big to me that in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, sometimes at the time, it's a big deal, but when you actually take a breath and back up and take a look at it, then it's like, okay.
Yeah.
And then you actually have a clear vision of how to persevere through or, you know, that's one of the things like, building and sports and competitive stuff, it really teaches you how to problem solve. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I love doing, like whether it's real estate or whether it's, you know, golf or whether it's, you know, building. I mean, you're all obviously everything looks great in the blueprints and on paper and the engineer says one thing and the architect says another. At the end of the day, it's Luke or, you know, whoever that's problem solving and making those choices moving forward, right? Yeah. That's something you can't teach. That's something, you know, that's in you, right?
Yeah. Learn through experience.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
And then you said your kids play golf and hockey and that's, they're still doing that. Is that right?
So,
because they're how old again?
Okay, 20 and 17. So my son got into junior golf, right? Kind of the same avenue. I wanted to expose him to that. And I exposed them to all the sports, both kids. And just if they loved it and wanted to do it, then that's great. If they didn't love it, my kids didn't love golf, that's fine. Just because I did it doesn't mean anything, right? But he loves it. He's on year two of his golf scholarship in Illinois. He graduates next month, and then he's committed to Bethel University in Tennessee for years three and years four. So that's a NAIA Division I golf school that he's going to go to. So he's going to be playing really high level. And then my daughter's in grade 12, and she's committed to NCAA Division II, in Menlo Park, which is California, Silicon Valley. So she'll be heading there in August. So yeah, both kids on golf scholarships, couldn't be prouder. That's you know, because awesome. I helped them through that. It's golf is more than just a sport. It, you know, it teaches you so many things about yourself, how to conduct yourself, how to control your emotions, And they both love it. And you know what? If they can get an education out of it, that's a win-win for me. And that's a win for them, obviously, right?
Who drives further, you or your son?
I think he's got me now.
Yeah.
I'm getting old. Like my flexibility, I noticed, isn't there. I'm hitting it like, you know, 285.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He's hitting it like probably 310-ish now, right? Yeah.
Has he beat you?
Yeah.
At times?
Yes. So I'll never forget the first time he beat me. At times we still like we're probably
competitive.
Oh
sure.
Yeah, for sure. He beat me at Predator Ridge. We went on a father-son golf trip. We played like 6 rounds in 3 days or 36 a day.
That's awesome.
And I just literally getting like old and tired. Yeah. And he's like, he's just like, I gotta beat you. And I think he got me on the fifth round. And it came down to the last hole and he made like a 20-footer from off the fringe downhill. And I was like, oh, it's over. You know, I was so proud of him though, because I knew it was coming. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
And then to do it there and just, we had a moment, a good hug, and it was awesome. And now it's more chirping and trash talking going on, right? You wait till I get home, Dad, I'm going to kick your butt. And, oh, yeah. That's okay, great. Well, you can hit it by me all day, but I still got a pretty decent short game, right?
Yeah. Drive for show.
Yeah, that's right. And then, my daughter, she's playing the junior tour, like I mentioned earlier, right? And she'll play provincials. And I'm actually trying to get her into playing the women's amateur, which is actually being hosted in Penticton this year. So it's like, you know what? You're going to be playing with some, you know, women that hit the ball and are very, very good. It'd be a good competition, get you kind of fired up for school. And
that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Well, I'm gonna get you out next week. I'm so excited to play with you and pick your brain and learn whatever I can. And
don't sell yourself short. You're 2 handicapped
at times.
A 2,
that's
pretty good. Luke.
2-3 is where I've finished last year. This year, I've been shooting in the 70s.
Yeah.
So far, just and then a 75.
Well, you're 75 with a double on 18 or a bogey on 18.
And he's only been playing however many years. You know, it's like he hasn't been playing that long. Where it's
I started the same time I started leatherwork. Yeah, it's kind of the same. Those two. Good. Passions, if you call them.
Because we used to actually on the Gulf Islands, it was our cousins that we used to hit in their backyard when we were really, really kids with wiffle balls.
Wiffle balls into ice cream.
Yeah.
Buckets,
Yeah, also they did.
And then it was on the island, on Thetis Island, there was a couple of 7 irons kicking around that somebody had, and we would go down to the field and just hit those back and forth. Yeah. And then it wasn't until, years and years later that you actually picked it up. Mm-hmm. And probably like Luke's such a student and wants to do everything. Like I think golf fits his personality to a T because there's, and again, it's that to a T. And it's, I think it's also due because similar to like what you said before, you're playing against yourself. You know, it's not a sport thing. And I think for certain characteristics, certain personalities, that's perfect, right? Because they're, you know, I mean, you could be playing with somebody else with a team and, you know, like you said, so-and-so screwed this up. Whereas this, it's fully you and the course and that ball. And so it's...
And that's my biggest struggle. And that's actually what I'm almost most fascinated by is watching you play. I mean, to play at that level for that length of time and the way you mentally address the game, your course management and dealing with the emotions. I've got a super, super loud, brutal inner critic and I'm hard on myself. I'm competitive internally, not to say that you aren't, but that is a side for me that is like an issue I have to like really, really work on. And there's usually 4 rounds a year. I'll get partway through a round. I'm like, I need to be done.
Right.
I'm going to go home.
Yeah.
This is
that's enough.
That's enough. Thanks everybody. It's
we
been
all
a pleasure.
Yeah.
before I get to be too outrageous. So I'm really looking forward to kind of trying to pick up whatever techniques and tips that you're going to share and just watching how you conduct yourself and play. It'd be great.
If you guys need a caddy, let me know.
Come on over. Yeah. There's a huge difference between, you're going to be top 5% in your golf club, you know, being with your handicap. Competitive tournament golf is so much different than just going out there like we were going to do and have some fun. There's just, it's some people can be scratch golfers and you get them in a tournament and they're shooting 85.
Yeah.
Like they just don't have it mentally. And they're so like, it's a whole nother skill set.
Yeah.
To be able to play in tournament level. Right. And I know a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
Right. And you can't teach that either. It's you have to figure it out.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, yeah,
Well, this has been a pleasure. Been so fun.
Absolutely. It's great to see you guys again.
Have you back and do it again sometime would be awesome.
We all growed up.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's ridiculous. All right. Well, thanks much, Brooks. Yeah. Thanks, Brad, for co-hosting. Thanks, Dustin, behind the cameras, taking care of us. And everybody, we'll catch you again next time. Thanks for watching, listening.
Pleasure.
Thanks.